So Keanu Reeves was placed on the throne by the vizier after the Janissaries triggered a coup against Selim III, because why was Selim couped? He wanted to make the government work, so that way they wouldn't lose all the territories, that the European powers wouldn't come in and carve up the empire. But the Janissaries were not happy about it. Neither was the bureaucracy. So they fought Wadham, which justified the religious removal, and then they put a puppet on the throne. But when he got on the throne, some of the provinces rebelled, and they marched to put the legitimate sultan back on the throne. But by the time he arrived, he was dead. So what did the vizier do? Well, they got Mustafa off the throne, and they put Mahmud on. And that's where we left off. Mahmud II would come to the throne in 1808. And he would remain sultan for the next 30 years. Now, by the way, this is a dynasty. All of the Ottoman sultans, they're all blood relatives. But he was Mustafa's half-brother.
So around what time was he placed on the throne?
1808. When he came to the throne, though, the first thing he wanted to do was to pick up the reforms of Selim. But he wasn't dumb. He knew what happened to Selim. He knew what Selim wanted to do. He knew what stopped him. And they knew what his fate was. And frankly, he didn't want to be couped or strangled. So what does he decide to do? Well, this time, he decides to reach out to his foreign advisors to get some guidance. He talks to Prussia. He talks to the English. He talks to the French. He talks to the Austrians. He talks to the Russians. And he explains, look, I know we're borrowing money, and I know we gotta pay it back, but I can't do it if I can't control my own country. So I think I need some help building a modern army. So, in the far off places, within the corners of the empire, they start recruiting Turks, transporting them to the far outside corners. And they bring in foreign generals and officers who begin training these recruits in the ways of Western modern warfare. He also begins squirreling money out of the budget. And he starts buying modern weaponry, modern equipment, because he realizes the only way this modern army can fight is if they have the arms to do it. For 18 years, little bits and dribbles and drabs. He couldn't do anything big, because he knew it could trigger a revolt by either the Janissaries, or the Ulema, or the bureaucrats, or even the vizier. So he had to be careful. But when he was ready, he would trigger a Janissary mutiny. In 1826, he sends out his agents who act as counter-agents, seemingly, and they let slip to the Janissaries that the Sultan now has a new army, and that the army is going to be used against the Janissaries. Well, that causes them to freak out. According to the words that survive from the primary sources, the Janissaries began flipping the cauldrons of food in the mess hall as a sign of its anger, because it was the Sultan who gave them the food. They then pour onto the streets. They plan on marching on the palace. But unbeknownst to the Janissaries, the Sultan, as the head religious figure in the empire, declares jihad. Holy war on the Janissaries. He claims that they are not practicing the true form of Islam, and that they are stifling the expansion of Islam, which of course is the whole mission of the Sultan, Usman's dream. Well, the moment this occurs, he basically justifies what happens next. His new army had modern artillery, and they had moved it all within firing range of the city. And they located all of the field pieces and targeted where the Janissaries' barracks were. And they just started opening fire. Of course, they couldn't hit everything and everyone. But as the barracks get set ablaze, 4,000 people would be burned to death as a result of the bombardment. While tens of thousands of others poured out onto the streets, and every single street coming away from where the barracks were units of the new soldiers, sat there and just went ba-boom, 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 volley after volley. There were few survivors. There were even fewer men who managed to escape the city alive. But those who were taken prisoners were decapitated on the spot. In a matter of an hour, 135,000 Janissaries were completely eradicated. Mahmud then declared the order to be criminals against the empire and forever banish them. Then he sends word to the religious priests, the ulama, and says, what are you going to do about it? You don't have the Janissaries to protect you now. Are you going to issue a fatwa against me? To which they all quickly, wisely said, no. Well, just like that, he wiped out two of the six factions that all sultans had to deal with. What do you think the bureaucrats were going to say? They weren't going to say anything. What do you think the provisional governor was going to say? Oh, nothing. Oh, by the way, the vizier was completely on board, as were the Turkish nobles. So now he secured his position on the throne, wiped out his opponents. Now he's in charge. Guess what he decides to do? He would attempt to save his empire. He would be the only sultan in Ottoman history to attempt to modernize his empire. In 1839, he would issue what is known as the Tanzimat Furmani. The Tanzimat Furmani, which is Turkish for the Reorganization Decree. The Reorganization Decree. He was going to reorganize the state. As he said in his decree, that he wished to, and I quote, bring the benefits of good administration to the provinces of the Ottoman Empire through new institutions. He was going to clean house and reform it to try to save it. In this decree, all of the called for reforms would be based upon Western precedents. So what were they doing in Europe? Constitutions, parliaments, elections, bills of rights. All the things that Western Europe had that the Ottoman Empire did not. Unfortunately, before the machine could get going, he died. But the mantle was taken up by both of his sons. His first immediate successor was Abdulmajid I, and his second son, who would succeed his brother when he died, was Abdulaziz. For the next 30 years, these two sultans oversaw the modernization of this empire. An empire that had not had any change since Mehmed the Conqueror seized Constantinople. And it literally went down to the individual citizen. It was a full-blown social revolution. The people, for example, stopped being subjects and started being citizens. And how did they do it? Laws. They scrapped all of the laws that were on the books, and they replaced it with a new code, both criminal law and civil law. Literally, the behaviors that were allowed, the behaviors that were illegal. What's the process of starting a business? What's the process of getting married? What's the process of owning a house? All of those things that we all take for granted of, they were all scrapped and replaced. He also created a professional civil service. The most important thing he did was he actually started sending diplomats, ambassadors, out to other countries and allowing other countries to come in and set up embassies in Constantinople, so that way he could be part of the world community. Or they could, because we're talking about two sultans. Society itself was transformed. Clothing. They got rid of the traditional dress. And Western-style clothing started being worn. Men wore suits, for example. Education was Westernized. Instead of schools being just religious madrasas, they were replaced with universities that taught Western curriculum. Liberal arts, sciences, humanities, mathematics. They also removed all of the cultural and religious and ethnic differences that existed in the empire. Now, whether you were a Muslim or not, whether you were white, brown, black, dark, or somewhere in between, didn't matter. If you were born in the empire, you were a citizen of the empire. And in the constitution, there were guarantees, protections of civil liberties. The biggest of which was a promise by the government that they would protect the lives and property of all citizens. Slavery was abolished. Ironically, it was the Muslims that started the African slave trade. Well, in 1847, the Ottoman Empire said, no more. No more slavery anywhere in the empire. No more slave trade. Oh, and no more devshrim. The blood tax. When parents had to give up their sons to the state to keep their religion. It was all abolished. The army was expanded. And it would be modeled along Western lines. Meaning, everybody were in units. They had distinct armies. They were ranks for the officers. It no longer was based on your tribe or your clan. They also implemented one of the most effective postage systems anywhere on the earth at the time. They brought in European companies. They built railroads, crisscrossing the empire. And wherever the railroads went, they laid telegraph lines, which allowed instantaneous communication. Everything was on the move towards modernity. And the capstone was the final product, which would be issued in 1876, a new constitution. It would be based upon the English system. So there would be a parliament. Delegates would be elected by the people. The presiding officer would be the vizier, who became more like a prime minister or a chancellor, or whatever you want to call him. The country would be a constitutional monarchy in which the king or the sultan would have the power to declare war, to appoint ministers, sign off on laws, but he could not issue decrees. There were checks and balances in the system. Islam was still the state religion, but all religions received protection. And other things that we take for granted of. Due process, ownership of property, free press, all of those things that were put in there.
Is there any heavily in debt? How much bigger did the...
A lot more. A lot more.
Is the reason why the collapse in 1918?
Part of it. Do you have a question? I thought I saw your hand go up. What else have I got? Oh, and I said rights of all groups, minorities, everything was protected. But there were some people that still didn't get help. So, I hate to break it to you. The big losers, women. But artisans also were hurt because they were still borrowing money. And in order to pay off some of that money, they begin allowing those European countries to flood the market with mass-produced goods, which only put the artisans out of business. So handmade items were replaced by machine-made items. And women, well, Sharia law. Ladies still had to stay inside. They were not allowed to leave their homes without being escorted by a son or by their husbands. Men were allowed multiple wives. Islam allows polygamy. But the catch is that under Islamic rule, the man has to be able to support all of his wives equally. So the richer you are, the more wives you could have. I mean, heck, Muhammad had 9, including Aisha, who, when he got married, she was only 9 years old. He was like 50. Oh, and while men, their clothing was westernized, women still had to wear the burqas. head to toe, including covering the whole face. No, if you looked at the Turkish burkas at the time, they had cloth like grills, so it wasn't even just the eye slits.
Oh, so even it was those, like a veil?
Yeah, like a veil. Yep.
That's even scary.
But, truth be told, even though they went more in debt, the empire itself started to build in strength. The economy started growing. Tax collections increased. And it seemed like the nation was moving in the right direction. But once the Constitution was enacted, the Sultanate became like the king or queen of England. They were basically just figureheads, which meant they could not fulfill Uthman's dream. The job of the Sultan is to spread Islam and to destroy anyone who stands in the way. Being a figurehead, the Sultan could not do that. So, there were many conservatives, particularly among the ruling classes, the upper elite, that did not like these changes. And what they would do is they would end up coupling Abdulaziz, the second son of Mahmud II. These conservatives were opposed to the Tanzimat reforms. These conservatives were opposed to essentially the granting of equality and liberty and justice. So, Abdulaziz was removed from the throne and replaced with someone who the conservatives believed would be a puppet, Murad V. But shortly after Mahmud is put on the throne, he announces to the empire he's not going to overthrow the constitution. He will abide by it. Which does not make the conservatives happy. But there's little they can do about it because they just cooed one sultan. They knew they could never get away with cooing a second. But an opportunity rose when, after being sultan for 93 days, Murad falls ill. He becomes completely incapacitated. So when he was bedridden, that allowed the cabinet to cool because he didn't have the strength to resist. So now you've had 3 decades of change. You have a conservative elite that doesn't want the change, and they're using coups to remove weak sultans to get what they want. And man, did they get it. After Murad V was couped, the conservative elites would anoint Abdul Hamid II as Sultan in 1878. He, unlike his cousin Murad, viewed the Tanzimat reforms as a threat to the mission of the Sultan. Abdul Hamid was focused on achieving Uthman's dream, the mission of the founder of the dynasty, the driving force of the empire for 600 plus years. Well, he was going to bring it back. So, he announced he was not going to abide by the Constitution. using a weird mechanism that was put into the Constitution, which essentially allowed the Constitution to be suspended in times of emergency. The new Sultan literally suspended the Constitution, said it's no longer in effect. And by the way, if there is no Constitution, there is no frame of government. And there also is no protections of civil liberties. So essentially, he ripped up the rule book. He then had the army swear an oath of allegiance to him, personally, not the state. And he unleashed those forces. If you protested, you would be arrested. Sometimes tortured. Or killed. He then decided he wanted all of the Europeans out. Shut down all the embassies. Drove them all out under the threat of arrest. All except for the German military advisors. Why did he leave the Germans? Well, 1871, Germany was created.
Is this why they formed the pact?
1871, Germany was created when Prussia fought a war against France and kicked the living snot out of them. It, in terms of modern warfare, it was one of the most lopsided wars in all of European history. In a month, Prussia literally defeated all three of the French armies and captured the emperor. The only holdout was Paris itself. Well, in terms of 19th century racism, how do you prove your superiority?
Battlefield.
You win wars. And you can't get a better victory than that. So Abdul Hamid said, yeah, we like these Germans. So he allowed the Germans to stay, but everybody else, the English, the French, Spanish, all gone. And then he ruled as a tyrant. But the problem is, imagine a dog. There's a dog. You smack the dog. What's the dog gonna do?
Bite you.
Really?
Not right away.
He's going to bend, he's going to cower, he's going to be afraid. Smack him again. What's he going to do?
Well, technically it all depends on how you raise the dog.
Just saying.
What
type of dog it is. I've had some.
Because mommy's like Chihuahua, that thing's going to rack you.
You think so?
Because my dog.
Really? You know what's going to head up with a Chihuahua? It's going to get punted across the room.
Exactly.
It's going to
bite.
It depends
on the dog. You hit
I feel like little dogs get more scared, but it's the big dogs, like, because my dog, he don't like that, like getting hit, like pushed, he doesn't like that. So
if your dad smacks your dog.
Like, he'll try to, like, get at him, like, he'll growl and stuff. Like,
at your dad?
Yeah, he does it all the time to my stepdad.
Oh, stepdad. Was the stepdad around for the whole dog's life?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he raised him. He was the one who brought us the dog.
I was going to say, that's weird. Usually dogs cower to the owner. But eventually, you smack it, and eventually they're going to start growling. And that's what happens. But there was a danger. If anyone dared resist the Sultan in Turkey, what's going to happen to them?
Executed.
Chances are they're going to get killed. At the very least, they're going to end in a Turkish prison. Jane, any of you know about the world?
A little bit.
Do you want to end up in a Turkish prison?
No.
So, what ended up happening is people started fleeing. But as they fled, they started gathering in countries that allowed them to come in, like France, like England, for example. But one group in particular started organizing in Paris and started focusing on doing something about the Sultan. In 1889, the Ottoman Society for Union and Progress was formed at the University of Paris.
It's almost like the Korean War, how it kind of started. Or in the sense that it was one ruler, a group of people didn't like it, they left, they formed a different group, they got a military backing.
A Korean War?
Yeah.
The Korean War was...
parallel yeah. after World War II.
It was
not one country.
Yeah, Korean War was triggered... Vietnam, closer to Vietnam. All right, so anyways, these guys gather in Paris, mostly college students, and they start talking about doing something. And the one thing that they want, by the way, they're commonly referred to as the Young Turks. The one thing that they wanted to do is bring back the Constitution. Life was great under the Constitution. They had freedom, they had rights. So what does the Young Turks begin to do? Well, they begin printing pamphlets and papers criticizing the regime and calling for steps to repair the damage that has occurred. These were smuggled into the country and circulated. But of course, if you get caught,
you died.
Chances are you're going to be arrested and you're going to get shot. So it was a challenge. Eventually, the Young Turks take advantage of the French, start doing fundraising, and they start funneling some of that money into the country. And they begin plotting assassination attempts, killing government officials. They also try recruiting in the country, hoping to possibly maybe launch a coup or two or three. But the problem is that in Turkey, the army was the police, and the police was the army. So all of their early efforts were blocked because the army was loyal to the Sultan. But in 1908, the army's loyalty to the Sultan came to an end. Due to a complete economic collapse triggered by inflation caused by the rapid increasing of taxes and the regime's sudden claim they're not going to pay any debts they owe to the Europeans, which of course caused the Europeans to be very angry, there was a complete Black Friday type depression. This caused the people by the thousands to take to the streets in protest. And into this chaos, the Young Turks took advantage of. Just like Lenin and the Bolshevists, who raced back to Russia after the collapse of the Tsar's regime, the Young Turks quickly left France, made their way back to Constantinople, and pushed and spearheaded this revolt. But this time, joining the Young Turks were many of the low-ranking officers, not the generals, but the captains and the colonels, guys that were not allowed to get promoted because maybe they were not loyal enough to the Sultan. But they believed they had the skill and they should be able to get those roles. So this time they saw what the Young Turks were doing and they ordered their men to stand down. Well, with no army to suppress the revolt, the regime collapsed. And Abdul Hamid would be deposed, kicked off the throne. But they needed a sultan. They needed a sultan. So with Abdul Hamid gone, they replaced him with a puppet, Mehmed V. who pledged he would work with the Young Turks to reestablish the Tanzimat Constitution. He also promised to restore all of the rights to which the people were once granted.
So were the Young Turks predecessors to the Black Hand?
The Black Hand were in Serbia.
And were they inspiration for
them? No. Black Hand was something completely different. The Black Hand was pushing for a pan-Slavic empire in the Balkans. So now, controlling the puppet, the Young Turks take over. They put the constitution back in place, and they would also go so far as to restore all of the freedoms, including the freedom of the press. Now, there is a danger in freedom. And the biggest danger comes from those who have never had freedom before. And suddenly, they're given all the freedom of the world.
They go crazy.
So I'll give you a perfect analogy. Not that it would happen to any of you here, because I know the campus is, generally speaking, dead. But I, as an undergrad, I went to the zoo. The University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I lived in Southwest, the part of the campus that has 22-story dorms. I lived in John Adams and George Washington, respectively, two of the five towers. And let me just tell you, Animal House, the movie, was real on UMass when I was there. Any day of the week, there was keg parties, there was craziness, it was just insane. It was too much for me. I actually transferred out. I couldn't take it anymore. I realized, okay, this is the most expensive keg party I've ever went to, and I'm not actually learning anything, and that's the reason why I went to college, so I ended up leaving. Some people can survive. I couldn't. I know it's changed. It's not quite as crazy as it once was, but it was insane. And why was it insane? Well, you put 17, 18, 19-year-olds who have lived under the iron fist of mom and dad, and then you suddenly put them into this place with thousands of other kids. And what are they gonna do? Kids are gonna run wild. By the way, I got to experience a little bit of it, much to Mrs. Professor Lemanic's chagrin, when this past Saturday I went to Boston to go see a show. And when we were on Lansdowne Street, I didn't realize that all of the Boston colleges and universities were doing a Halloween bar crawl. And let me tell you, watching all the college kids that were half naked and drunk was absolutely hilarious to me. Mrs. Professor Lemanic, she didn't care for it. But the question is would I have done what I did at UMass, or would any of these kids done what they did if they were still living at home with mom and dad? Absolutely not. But why do they think they could get away with it now? Because there's no parents around. Exactly. They have unlimited freedom. Just like what happened in Turkey. So, if you have one group that controls the message, that's all you're going to get. But when you open it up and allow everyone to have a say, that allows sometimes radicals on the ideological extremes to suddenly be able to have their say. And that could make things messy. Because shortly after giving the freedom of thought, of expressing, many of the people in government started listening to some of those extreme ideas. And it caused a slow metamorphosis, a change that occurred, particularly in the Young Turks. When they went from embracing Western-style freedom, equality, due process, to embracing ...19th-century racism and social Darwinism in the form of, as it became known, Islamic Turkish ultranationalism. They desired to create a new order based on Turkish nationalism. Now, the Ottoman Empire was a heterogeneous empire, meaning there was diversity. There were different races, there were different ethnicities, there were different cultures. But the Turks looked at who were the world powers at the time. England, France, Germany. What makes them special? Oh, they're not diverse. They have homogeneity. England, at the time, was full of English. France was full of French. Germany was full of Germans. There were no racial minorities. There was no diversity. And look what they were capable of doing. Conquering everyone. So, if they're winning wars, and they're all the same race, maybe we should do that too. So, more and more, the government started focusing on the idea of purging their society of those elements that lead to weakness, minorities. And it's no coincidence that around the same time, there would be a takeover from within. When three powerful ministers would emerge and unite and create effectively what becomes known as a triumvirate. Three men would take control. Enver Pasha, Minister of War, head of the army. Mehmed Talat Pasha, Minister of Internal Affairs, Minister of War, Minister of Internal Affairs. FYI, the Department of Internal Affairs controls all of the government property and infrastructure. So, we have the soldiers, we have the railroads and the roads and the ports and the warehouses, anything government owned. And now on the same page. And you have the highest ranking official in the capital of Constantinople, Ahmed Jamal Pasha. Ahmed Jamal Pasha. He was the military governor of Constantinople, who essentially was the head of the soldiers that were in the city as well as the police. These three men, because they controlled basically the military, would use their positions to do to the country what they wanted to. Now, FYI, they were all Germanophiles, meaning they loved Germany, what Germany was pre-World War I, where you had the Kaiser that was basically kind of like an absolute monarch, and the military maintained order. The military also controlled all transportation. So the soldiers built the roads, the soldiers built the railroads, the soldiers controlled the ports. And as we're going to see, the Kaiser would go around and practice Weltpolitik, flex his muscles all around the earth. making it so that way the German flag would basically shine over the world. Well, they sat back and said, yeah, that's what we like. But how are they going to use the military to purge Ottoman society so the Ottoman society could become strong? Oh, wait. You wait till the whole world is distracted with a global event, which today we refer to as the First World War. So, while everyone is paying attention to this hand, what's going on in the world, you know what they're not paying attention to? Attention to what I'm doing with the other hand, because everyone's distracted by this. Which means, what?
You stole.
I didn't steal anything.
I want.
This has always been in my hand. I don't know what you're talking about. So what would they do? Well, here you go. And this will be the last topic of the day. Their goal was to create a new order. In order to create a Turkish Islamic nationalist state, they needed a scapegoat to justify their actions. And you know what they decided to do? They decided to take advantage of the fact that the Turks, out of all of the countries that got into World War I, was probably the nation that really shouldn't have been there the most. They didn't belong there. They had nothing really to fight for. They only joined because Germany was in it. And they wanted to be with their friends. And their soldiers were not equipped. They didn't have enough bullets, for example. And pretty much everywhere they fought, they suffered huge losses. But why are they getting their butts whipped? Well, you know what the triumvirate would say? It's because of the Christians. Because it's the Christians and their prayers to that Jesus guy that's undermining our war effort. So the triumvirate tells the Sultan to declare jihad, which he does. And he declares jihad on all daime, all Christians and Jews, because they are conspiring with the enemy. They then deploy specialized units that go into the rural parts of the empire, village by village, and they begin purging villages of minority populace. They target Armenians, they target Assyrians, they target Greeks. The Christian groups. And they use the fog of war because no one's paying attention. And what do? Well, the soldiers come into a village. They order all of the men, going all the way down to the age of 6, to gather together. And they march them somewhere just out of sight of the central part of the village, usually just kind of like over a hill or around a bend. And then they shoot them all. They then come back and they gather up all of the women and all of the children and all of the elderly, and at gunpoint they begin marching them out into the deserts of the empire. All of the homes, all of the possessions, all confiscated. Anyone attempting to report these atrocities, shot on sight. The women are raped, they're assaulted. They're accosted. It gets so bad that mothers throw their newborn babies into the rivers just so the babies don't have to suffer. And in within 2 years, the government managed to purge its population of 2 million human beings. 1.2 million Armenians. 500,000 Assyrians, and 200,000 Greeks. resulting in the first genocide of the 20th century, in which the government selectively killed its own population to advance an idea. I got a little bit more because I got to bring the empire down, but we'll do that on Wednesday. I'll leave you with those images, though.